session, Judge Gaietis, Judge Sleeker, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Theodora Gaietis presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You may be seated. And today is September 12th, 2023. We have four cases scheduled for argument this morning. Looks like we are ready to begin with the first case on calendar, which is A230063, David Pekonen Appellant versus Housing Alternatives Development Company respondents. And counsel, just a few remarks before we turn things over to you this morning to begin your arguments. The podium in the middle is where you'll be making your arguments. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present. Respondent will have 15 minutes to present, and then appellant will have the opportunity to give a five-minute rebuttal argument. The podium itself is automated, so you can adjust it to your liking. It goes up and down before you begin your argument, and the time will be counted off for you so that you can keep good track of where you're at in your argument. The arguments this morning are both being live streamed and audio recorded. The audio recording will be available on our website shortly. In order to facilitate the audio recording, I just ask that you please introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing before you begin making your argument. And that concludes my remarks this morning. I will now turn things over to the lawyers, beginning with appellant. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Great. So, I turn up.
There's a button.
I'm sure there is, Sam.
You are at below your
up and down. See arrow buttons underneath middle of lectern.
Here, our marshal is going to help you.
I was going to say that's a little low.
There we go. I know, it's very low.
I sometimes can follow instructions.
Well, I can't tell you where the button is, frankly, so I'm glad you found it.
Thank you so much. May it please the court. My name is David Davenport. I'm here with my colleague Sam Johnson and our client Daniel Packin, and it's in the gallery today. I want to thank y'all. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. It's been a long time since I've been in this courtroom, and really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope everybody's doing well this morning. I think at base, what this really comes down to, and I'm sorry about my glasses. I'm struggling to get used to these things when I'm supposed to have them on and when I'm not, but I don't think there's any dispute that when Mr. Packinen was discharged, he was an employee of HADC Services. He had been an employee for a year and a half. Prior to that, he had been performing employment functions for HADC. It's not disputed that he was not classified as an employee of HADC when he was providing those employment services. Everybody agrees that he had a dual role. He was on the board. He provided all these employment-based services like other board of directors did during that 12-plus year period of time.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify when you said that discharge, that was during the second segment of the two different segments, and it involved a separate agreement that the jury found was an improper, basically, agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when you say no one disputes, is that really relevant to the issue here today? Because that was basically because the jury verdict is not the issue so much as the first time period.
Well, I would say it's important for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. Mainly, primarily, when we look through the lens of the Wage Payment Act and what is required to meet the prima facie elements of that act. Okay, so the act tells us that at the time of discharge, employees need to be paid what they're owed. That's kind of the layman's description of the act. At the time of discharge, he was an employee. That's undisputed. Now, prior, you know, a year and a half earlier, he had not been an employee of HADC for 12 plus years. He was receiving this defined benefit that only employees receive. It says in the life insurance plan, the contribution agreement, that this is a benefit that you will receive the cash out value of at the time your employment ends. He was not classified as an employee. He had a dual role. But when I look at the lens of the statute and why we're really here, it's because the statute says at the time the employment is terminated, employees need to get paid what they're owed. He was an employee at the time he was discharged in December of 2018. That should end the inquiry because he was an employee. Now, he had 14 years, I think it was, of accrued benefits paid into this contribution plan. They continued into the second phase of his role with HADC Services. He had all these benefits, $12,500, paid in on an annual basis when he was not an employee, but he was providing all the employment services. He then transitions to an employee status, continues to do all the same stuff. Nothing changed other than he moved from a non-classified employee to a classified employee, and they made contributions into that same account. So at the time he was discharged, the jury determined he had a $292,000 defined benefit that was wages due and owed to him. And at the time he was terminated, he was an employee. That's not disputed. He should be receiving the benefits of the statute. The statute kind of has two.
But Mr. Carpenter, I'm still a little bit unsure. The answer to my question is the jury in question eight, did the directors approve the employment agreement in good faith? And they said no. So that ended the employment agreement.
Correct.
But you're saying, and you've conceded, I think in your brief, and you've said it here today, and the judge found it in the evidence, that in the previous segment of six, seven, 8 years, whatever it was, he was not an employee. So I'm not quite sure I understand. Are you indicating that because in a non-good faith employment agreement would qualify someone to receive wages under the Act, therefore the judge erred in overturning the jury's verdict?
Well, I definitely think the judge erred in overturning the jury's verdict because she made supplemental findings without authority to do so. There was nothing that was omitted. But what I'm trying to get at,
Your Honor, what was supplemental about those findings? Weren't those findings the judge made was simply reiterating what the evidence the jury had heard?
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. I want to try to get back to your initial question. So I think what I would kind of throw back is, okay, then what was supposed to happen? What were those benefits that he was being paid? They were benefits that were paid to him for the employment services he was providing while he was at HADC. Okay, so then he becomes an employee. The statute doesn't say, well, when you're not an employee, but you're accruing employee benefits at the time of your discharge, we're not going to treat you like an employee. The statute says, at the time of your discharge, when you're terminated, you have to be paid what you're owed.
Counsel, I mean, I feel like this is somewhat of a problem of your own making. When I look at the special verdict form, there's no line item indicating, asking the jury to find that he's an employee, when he started becoming an employee for purposes of the wage statute. And the damages question is in answer to the section of the special verdict form regarding breach of contract, and there's no damages question for the payment of wages claim. So why isn't this all sort of waived by the failure to ask the right questions on the special verdict form?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, his status as an employee was never disputed. It only came up after we rested our case in chief.
And well, wouldn't you agree that you had the burden to establish his status as an employee, though?
I believe we did. We had admissions in the record. We had all sorts of procedural history whereby the court said as much, and then we got to trial and we presented all of this evidence of a dual role, and we have the alter ego finding, which is very significant because when you look at Gunderson tells us that this form over substance should not apply to deprive him of the benefits he's entitled to under the statute. And yes, Gunderson dealt with the Workers' Compensation Act, but for purposes of the Wages Act, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to apply that act in a manner that's beneficial to the employees, not to the employer. So in terms of was this an issue of our own making, I would respectfully disagree because in the instructions, it identifies employee a number of times. If they wanted to pivot after we rested our case in chief, which I believe they did, and say, he's not an employee, they shouldn't have admitted it. They should have had a question on there to say, is he an employee or is he not an employee? The jury implicitly found he was an employee because the instructions that they were given as much as said so. And so when they were asked, are these wages owed to him? That's what employees get. Employees are paid wages. And when you read the totality of the jury instructions, I think it's difficult for respondent to argue that it wasn't implicit in the jury's finding that he was an employee. If they said he was owed $292,000, they said it was wages. If he wasn't an employee, they would have said he's not owed anything. So in terms of kind of where we are, you know, we've talked about the purpose in terms of the standard of review. The additional findings from the court that we believe undermine the special verdict form is something that the court should review, as is the decision to reverse the jury's special verdict form. Now, in terms of, you know, the deference that we give to juries, we would respectfully suggest that the court did not have authority to supplement the jury. When you look at Rule 49.01A, the trial court can supplement findings on issues that have been omitted. This issue was not omitted. It was in the instructions. The Wage Act was there.
Mr. Carpenter, you again use the word supplement. Can you give me an example of a finding that the court supplemented as opposed to simply the reason I'm asking, as I read it, it appeared to me, and the case law, Lakeland, Tools, one case in particular that confirms that whether someone's employee is a mixed question of fact and law. So you wouldn't have an instruction, you wouldn't have a question to the jury, is he or she an employee? Instead, you would have facts presented, which is what the judge seemed to refer to as same things you were saying here today, that it was uncontested he was not an employee during that segment of time involving the life insurance payment, which the jury awarded him. So I'm not sure I understand how you're distinguishing supplementing findings as opposed to just entering a JMOB, a judgment against the verdict, which appeared to be what happened here.
Well, I think from my perspective, when the court issued its final judgment and it started making comments about jury maybe being confused, or it made some comments about Mr. Pakkinen was his own boss, nobody told him what to do, those were facts that the court kind of, I guess, sua sponte, just put into the final judgment. The evidence that was presented was consistent with him having this dual role throughout his entire tenure at HADC and HADC Services.
But part of those facts is your client agreed he wasn't an employee. I mean, they heard that.
Understood, yes.
Okay.
Yep. So for that period of time, he was not classified as an employee, but it's critically important, I think, the court recognized that he performed a dual role. He performed services as an employee. If he did not do those things, nobody else was there to do them. They testified that he provided an executive function. He functioned like a chief operating officer. He did all of these additional duties beyond just sitting on a board and attending quarterly meetings. And that evidence is undisputed. And so when we're looking at kind of the substance over the form, he functioned as an employee. And when we look at the Gunderson case tells us that that's really important when you're looking at statutes designed to protect workers in the state. So if you take Gunderson, effectively what the trial court did here was take these facts and not apply Gunderson and do the opposite of Gunderson and say, well, I tell you what, for purposes of the Workers' Compensation Act, you're not going to be treated as an employee despite the fact that there's this alter ego and you're doing everything that an employee does. Gunderson looked at that and said, no, we're not going to deprive that worker of the protections that the legislature said employees are supposed to have. That same logic, that same rationale applies to the Wages Act. The Wage Act is designed to protect our workforce and to make sure that employers do what they're supposed to do. I do think it's an important point to reiterate. It talks about at the time of discharge, you have to pay the employees what they're owed. He was an employee.
I want to make sure I'm fully understanding your argument. So your argument is he was an employee at the time of discharge. But during all those years when he was a board member, you agree, as he testified, that he was not an employee. Is that?
That's right.
But because at the time of his discharge, he was an employee, somehow all of those years when he wasn't an employee gets sort of grandfathered in. Is that what your argument is?
Yeah, okay. That's part of it.
I just wanted to make sure I was understanding.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, right? Because the statute talks about pay employees what they're owed when they're discharged. There's no dispute.
Regardless of employment status.
Prior.
Right. At the moment of discharge, if the person is an employee, then they are entitled to be paid for anything that occurred prior to that moment.
Whatever they're owed, whatever is due and owing. That's what the statute says, wages that are due and owing. And the jury...
Wages, if he's not an employee. So all that time when he's not an employee, he's not earning wages.
He was not earning wages. He was being paid the stipend.
Compensated.
He was being compensated.
But they weren't wages.
Correct.
So how does the wage statute enable payment of something that may be owed, compensation that may be owed, but are not wages?
Because what was in the defined benefit plan was a contribution that he was entitled to, were contributions into the life insurance plan that he was entitled to cash out as compensation. We can call it compensation.
That's a contractual issue, right? I mean, you're talking about there was an agreement, it provided for payment. I'm talking about the statute. What language in the statute allows for collection of something other than wages?
I got to pull up the statute. I apologize. I can do that for rebuttal. I'll have that handy.
Thank you.
In terms of the procedural history and the procedural posture, I think you'll see a lot of evidence in the record where this issue of employment, whether he was an employee or not, had been dealt with in many different motions. Most importantly, they never contested that he was not an employee for purposes of the statute. They just said he's not owed these monies. These aren't wages. He shouldn't be entitled to receive them. So that goes to the arguments we've made relative to unfair surprise. I think kind of 15 seconds, the last thing I'll say is the accrual of the deferred compensation benefits lends itself to a finding of employment status, regardless of whether or not he was classified as such.
All right, thank you very much for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And now we'll hear from respondent.
Good morning. My name is Erin Conlon, and I am here on behalf of both respondents, Housing Alternatives Development Company and HADC Services, along with my colleague, David Schooler. May it please the court. At trial, appellant Daniel Packinen testified, I was not an employee. Yet here we are on appeal, and Packinen is attempting to ask this court to find the exact opposite of his own testimony. This case has always been a contract dispute. Two contracts were at issue at trial, one that Daniel Packinen had with HADC that he entered into in 2004, and one that he entered into in 2017 with HADC Services. The jury awarded Packinen damages pursuant only to that first 2004 contract with HADC. Now, appellate's motivation here is clear. He seeks to apply an employment claim to this contract dispute in an attempt to recover his attorney's fees and costs. But the court should reject appellant's attempt to shove a square peg into a round hole where this has always been a contract dispute. Instead, respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision on the 181.13 claim that Packinen was not an employee, that he was not owed wages, and third, as to this alternative alter ego claim, it has no application to confer employment status where none exists. This would be a novel, brand new use of the alter ego claim in this context.
Ms. Conlon, can I ask, I assume you're not going to agree with Mr. Carpenter that you've conceded he was employment. I understand, in fact, you clarified in your reply, in your brief, that it, during that second period, that there apparently was no dispute that he was, there was an employment agreement, whereas the first one specifically excluded a contract of employment, I think was the phrase in the, but why, it seems at a minimum that, that your client, at least as to that first time period, didn't previously litigate that issue, and I'm just curious why it got to the jury. Why wasn't there? It seems like the facts were really not in dispute. As to, in fact, they are. They're all agreeing. I served on the board. I'm not an employee. How did it? Why did it get to the jury? I mean.
Sure, Your Honor. And I believe the question and what's raised in the brief by appellant is that HADC had previously brought a motion to dismiss under Rule 12 and a motion for summary judgment under Rule 56. And so the question is, why wasn't this previously briefed, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, until during and after trial as a JMAL motion? And that's because of the way the evidence came in. Pakkinen, during direct examination, testified for the first time in a full sentence, unlike in the prior deposition testimony, I was not an employee. And it's not just that one statement that we're relying on. It's also other evidence, the way that it came in at trial.
Why didn't you ask for a special interrogatory of the jury as to whether he was an employee? I mean, that seems like that would have been the threshold question on the wage claim. If he's not an employee, then he's not entitled to back wages. So why didn't you ask for it?
We agree, Your Honor, that it would be a threshold question. It would be the essential first element of a 181.13 claim. Again, the pretrial pleadings that we submitted in terms of jury instructions and our proposed special verdict form was submitted before the evidence at trial came in with the statement, I was not an employee, with Pakkinen's admission on the stand that he was paid director's fees via 1099 tax form, not via W-2, that he held full-time employment at a different company that was not HADC or HAD services during the entire time that he served on the board. So because of his testimony on the stand that came after we had submitted our pretrial filings, then that led to the JMAL motion, which the first element, we argued that Pakkinen had the burden of proving employment status. He failed to do so during his case in chief. And so that motion was timely made based on the evidence in the record at trial.
Just to follow up on that notion, Mr. Pakkinen seems to be suggesting that because the element of whether he was an employee was never disputed, that respondents were kind of, you know, lying in wait and sort of sprung as a surprise on the case that after the jury's verdict, the notion that perhaps he was not an employee. And what's your response to that?
As to the notion of surprise, Your Honor, I would argue there was simply no surprise here. Certainly, it has always been HADC's contention since the beginning of litigation that 181.13 doesn't apply. And yes, while the issue of employment status was not brought up until the JMAL motion, again, this was because of the way that the evidence came in at trial. There was no lying in wait. There was no attempt to get this to trial and then to, you know, spring this argument on later. There was no, you know, I think that this is a waiver issue about whether HADC waived this employment status. But there's nothing in the record that Pakkinen can point to of a known relinquishment, an intentional relinquishment of this known right. Nowhere does HADC come out and say, yes, he was an employee when he was a board member from 2004 to 2017. There's no concession he was an employee. There's no concession of this dual role phrase that Pakkinen is relying on to establish an employment relationship. There is no waiver. The motion was timely brought at the close of Pakkinen's case in chief. As to the second issue of the definition of wages, HADC asked this court to look at Cole v. Holland, which is a 2004 unpublished case from the Court of Appeals, which specifically says that severance benefits aren't wages. And that's because they're not due and owing until this triggering event, separation or termination from employment. Now, Pakkinen asked this court to ignore Cole and instead to look at a line of cases that has to do with PTO or vacation pay, but that is substantively different. We all know what PTO and vacation pay is for. During the course of employment, you can say, hey, I want to take next week off, whether that be paid or unpaid, but it's a benefit that you can use during the course of your employment. That is part and parcel different from a severance benefit, or here what we're talking about is a post-termination of service benefit. It could only be due and owing after that triggering event of termination. And so it's not wages for purposes of 181.13. I also want to address...
Before you do, Ms. Conlon, I had asked Mr. Carpenter about supplemental findings because he used that phrase today and in his briefing. Why do you disagree with that, or is there anything wrong with that? But can you give me your thoughts on whether those findings by the court as it relates to his employment status or lack thereof were supplemental or not?
The question was omitted from the special verdict form about whether Pakkinen was an employee during that first segment that we're talking about here, that April 2004 to March of 2017. There was no question, was Pakkinen an employee? There was just a question about wages. And so because there was not a question submitted to the jury, under Rule 49.01A, the district court retains the authority to issue this factual finding to render the judgment complete. And as we were discussing earlier, employment is that first essential element of a 181 claim. And so based on the evidence that came in at trial, what Judge Burke stated in her judgment was that there no reasonable jury could find that 181.13 applies here because of the admission and because of the evidence that he was not an employee.
Counsel, in fairness to the appellant, their argument is that the substance of the jury instruction provides that the jurors can only find that wages are due and owing to an employee. So necessarily, the jury must have followed those jury instructions, assumed that he was an employee, and answered the questions accordingly. Why is that? What's your response to that argument?
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because there are
shocked.
there are separate elements of most claims, and as is true of a 181 claim, you have to be an employee and there has to be wages. Both of those words are used and have distinct meanings, and courts have looked at the meanings of what each of those words mean individually. And so for employment, for example, under a 181.13 claim, while employee is not defined, independent contractor is. And independent contractors are specifically left out of the timely payment of wages statute. And so there are certain categories of people who provide services, who are given compensation, who aren't employees, and who don't have the benefit of 181 claims. That's the same here with board members. They're not an employee, and so their director's fees that Pakkinen was given on a monthly basis were not wages. Addressing this alter ego claim, we all know what an alter ego claim is typically designed to do based on the 1979 seminal Victoria Elevator 8-factor test. It's designed to pierce the corporate veil. If any plaintiff gets a judgment against a subsidiary entity, they can potentially pierce the corporate veil if they can use this 8-factor test so that they can get a judgment that they are due and owed. And so what Pakkinen did about a year into litigation is he amended his complaint to add this alter ego theory, this alter ego claim, for that very purpose. He wanted to say, if I get a judgment against HADC Services, the subsidiary entity under this second contract, I can recover from the parent, HADC. But that claim is now entirely moot because there is no judgment against HADC Services. There's no way to use the alter ego theory in the way that Pakkinen sought to when he amended his complaint. There's no need to pierce any corporate veil. The only judgment that was given to him by the jury is against the parent, HADC. So instead, what Pakkinen is trying to do is rely on Gunderson to have this court apply the alter ego theory in a completely novel way. Now, Gunderson is a 2001 case, and it did deal with the alter ego theory and who was the employer. But it was specifically isolated to the Workers' Compensation Act, and that's an entirely different beast, and it has different rules than other employment statutes like 181.13. So in Gunderson, what we had was an orthodontia office where Harrington Orthodontia, Dr. Harrington was the sole owner and operator of that office. And there what the court held is that the exclusivity provision in the Workers' Compensation Act, where an employee can only get damages for a workplace injury, applied such that he couldn't have another claim against Dr. Harrington separately for an injury that he suffered at work, that his only remedy in that case was to go through the Workers' Compensation Act. None of that is applicable here. We don't have a workplace injury. We don't have a sole ownership and proprietorship. We're dealing with two separate entities, and the Victoria elevator factors are what governs whether an alter ego theory applies. And also importantly here, there is a established legal test for determining whether two entities can be considered an employer of the same employee. It's the joint employer test. But there's no pleading, no record evidence, nothing in the briefing here talking about a joint employer analysis. And that would be the correct vehicle to try and hold two entities liable as an employer. That's not what we're talking about. We're using this novel bending of an alter ego theory claim that has no application to confer employment status back to 2004 when Pakkinen only became an employee 13 years later. What I hear appellant's counsel saying today is that somehow this can be backdated. Gunderson offers no authority for that. When the contract was entered into in 2004, there was no employment contemplated. Yes, he became an employee much later in 2017, but there's nothing to show that that was somehow contemplated under the terms of the agreement that were written and signed and entered into in 2004. And for those reasons, under the meaning of employee, the meaning of wages, and the inapplicability of the alter ego claim, we ask that this court would affirm the district court's decision that the 181.13 claim fails. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honor, to answer your question, wages is not defined in the statute, but we Google searched, which is always the best legal research, right? But to try to find a dictionary definition of wages, it's a payment usually of money for labor or services on an hourly, daily, or piecemeal basis. So it starts off with wages are a payment. Compensation is defined to be a payment, right? So compensation is consumed within the definition of wages. And when we look at kind of what are examples of wages, we see that bonuses, deferred compensation, are wages, right? So this defined benefit plan was deferred compensation as the agreement defined it for employment services that were being provided while he was there at HADC providing a dual role, performing employment functions, and a board member.
What do you make of the provisions of the statute of 181 that talk about how wages are a beast that needs to be paid every 15 days, that they're subject to certain payroll deductions, that they're things like that. And I mean, the things that were paid under the original contract are not those things. They're not things that were paid every 15 days, which is what's contemplated under the statute.
I would say that's because wages can constitute any number of forms of compensation. So they could be hourly pay. They could be things that lend themselves to those types of withholdings and those types of deductions. But when it comes to this defined deferred compensation, it's a lump sum amount being put into this deferred benefit plan that will become doable, they'll become payable to him under that contract when those employment services end. It's called the termination benefit, so it becomes due at the time of his discharge, or I think it says at the time of his separation, which is the same thing.
Ms. Conlon argued that it was more akin to a severance benefit, which does not constitute a wage?
I heard all of that at trial, and the jury disagreed, and the jury said these were wages. So I don't think that they can, and they haven't appealed that, right? So the jury made.
Where did the jury say they were wages? Because I have a problem with that argument, counsel. Question five says, what amount of money, if any, will fairly and adequately compensate Daniel Pakkinen for the breach of the life insurance agreement? And that's the dollar amount. I don't see wages in that question.
My apologies. I'm looking at instruction number 23 from the jury instructions, where it talks about under the Minnesota Payment of Wages Act, when an employer discharges an employee, the wages or commissions actually earned and unpaid at the time of discharge are immediately due and payable upon the demand of the employee. So that's where I believe when the jury says this is what he was owed under that plan, they have, one, implicitly taken these instructions to determine he is an employee that is owed these amounts, and these amounts constitute wages. So I'm sorry if I misspoke and led to some confusion there.
So your argument just relies on two implicit jury findings. One, that these were wages, and two, that he was an employee. Would you agree that your argument hinges on two?
Not entirely, because we have the alter ego finding, right? And the alter ego question, with all due respect to counsel, was a very important question and was asserted in part not for collection. We didn't put the cart before the horse and try to do this for collection purposes. We have an alter ego theory that the jury said, yes, they are, because they so dominate and control. And because of that domination and control, they are effectively the employer. Right, that's the Gunderson case, and that's the theory, and that's what allows for, when you're trying to harmonize what the special verdict form was with the final judgment, the court's supposed to look for everything it can to harmonize that, unless it's palpably unfair or whatever that
language said. But to get to that point, Mr. Carpenter, doesn't the alter ego have to stand for itself legally? So we have an advisory jury instruction, which the district court disagreed with and found separately that there was no alter ego. And if we agree with that, doesn't that just stop? There's nothing to harmonize, in other words.
Well, I think that what the court did was it erred there because it looked at piercing the corporate veil rather than looking at what the alter ego theory was, which was a theory to help establish employment. We believe employment was admitted. We believe all of the things that are in our papers relative to his status. And what they told the Minnesota Attorney General's office when they came knocking, right, this notion that this was somehow a surprise, that Mr. Packinen acknowledged he was not an employee at HADC at a particular period of time, nobody was surprised by that. Everybody knew that. So the notion that this just kind of came up last minute and then they just pivoted and it's not unfair to us, it just doesn't jive with the record. I'm out of time, but I'll keep talking if you have questions. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right,
thank you very much for your very helpful arguments this morning, both counsel. We appreciate it. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame, which is 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you.